Let us pray. O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Blessed Master,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
From something that I wrote at Cloud Mountain on June 8, 2001. Staying connected to a discipline for the fruition of a devotee. The devotee is able to flower when hanging on the branch of a tree. The branch is the guru teacher. The tree is universal life. There are many branches on the tree that bring forth fruit. Of this there is no doubt, and the fruit of one branch is as sweet as another. After the initial flowering, the honeymoon stage, the flower drops off to reveal a little green nub. Through the season, that green nub grows in size but remains hard. Towards the end of its cycle, it becomes very soft and sweet. The longer it hangs there, the softer and sweeter it gets. For any who tastes that ripened fruit, there is nothing better in the world. And from Master's talk that we have, these are available to everyone who would like to check them out from the center leaders. And they're wonderful. They're his original transcripts. And this is entitled, For What Religion Are You Best Suited? Today's subject is a vast one in connection with religion, which is best suited for you. Religion comes from the Latin word religare, to collect together, to go over in thought. The origin of this Latin word has been subject of discussion since the time of Cicero. It is something which you talk over in connection with God hereafter. Whence do we come? Why are we here? And whither do we go? It seems life is so prosaic that many people don't try to challenge at all. But life is very dramatic and very mystical. You look about you and you find many people who are once here and now gone. They were just as alive as you are. Life seems very cruel now and mysterious, and unless you try to understand life, you will see that your fate will be the same as the cow's body which you are now wearing as shoes. The shoes you are now wearing belong to a cow grazing in the field, but it is your shoes now. It seems we eventually become ashes in a cemetery or flesh embalmed beneath a tomb. But life isn't that. When you cut your nails, you don't feel it. So you don't need fear that when the life is gone from your body, you will suffer in the frave or burn in eternal fires. The body becomes paralyzed in death. You don't feel pain. Death is a blessing when it comes. But what is God? What is life? What is the hereafter? These are the questions of religion. Religion has different thoughts, moral consciousness, ethics, psychology, and philosophy and religious practices. Psychology tells us how to behave. Ethics tells you what you should be. I'm not sure how to pronounce this next word. Eschatology deals with immortality, resurrection, hereafter, and so on. Ontology deals with the science of real being. Psychology analyzes you. Psychological analysis of yourself is necessary that you may adopt the rules of ethics in order to make yourself what you should be. Unless you know what you are, how can you change yourself? But you are pretty much aware of your own faults unless somebody tells you you are bad, and then you don't want to admit it. The master always said to not admit your faults to others, but change yourself within silently. Because if you tell your faults to others, when they get mad at you, they will throw those faults up to you. That is why when two people get married, they should not tell about their past, because when they become angry, they will bring up those things. What is past is past. Friendship exists in marriage. You must take each other as you are. But two people cannot get along until they always try to follow this road of ethics. If you give reasons, people will respect you. You shouldn't force people to be one way unless you give reasons. Master never forced anybody. He would reason. He would say, "Don't you think this to so?" I lived with one of the greatest wise men who never forced us, but gave reasons as to why we should do a certain way. So what is important is to analyze yourself and then follow the ethical way as to what you should be. So many people who analyze others forget to analyze themselves. But if you are busy changing yourself, you have no time to criticize others. It is the job of a guru who has analyzed his own conduct and adopted the necessary ethics to do the disciplining of others. And never tell anything to anybody unless it is wanted. That is a better way. Now, epistemological question is first brought in by Kant. He said that the earlier philosophers always assumed that we could know truth. But have we the power to know truth? Just like all people on Earth before the discovery of the telescope said that there was a man in the moon. But they found out by using the telescope that what looked like a man in the moon was a mountainous region and craters on the moon's surface. So sensation, if they lie, the inference is wrong too. Sensations can measure phenomena, but they cannot measure substance. The ocean is the substance, and the wave is the phenomenon. God is the noumena, and nature is the phenomena. So you cannot know the noumenal by reason, because you don't see it, like the wind. You feel it through your body. Therefore, your reason tells you there is wind, but you can't feel God. And how can you know he is? By intuition. But Kant said the mind cannot hold the whole truth, so we have to develop intuition. The epistemological question brings out his development of intuition as the power by which one can know God. Then comes religion. You can be ethical without being religious. You can be a moralist without being religious. Isaac Newton was a great moralist, but he was not religious. But real religion says that analyzing oneself and adopting rules of ethical conduct are not enough. We should analyze the purpose of life. That is where philosophy comes in. It asks, what is hereafter? That is the science of eschatology, the study of the hereafter, immortality, resurrection, etc. But after you have dealt with that, the purpose of life is to find happiness. Where can you find that happiness? Within. It will not be found in worldly things. If you don't make your life internal, you will never find happiness at all. Happiness lies within oneself. It is in a palace you can be miserable, and in a hut you can be a king. You can carry a portable heaven or Hades within yourself. But the true meaning of religion is this: destruction of threefold suffering, physical, mental, spiritual, by the roots, so that there is no possibility of recurrence. Now, religion today can be classified into three parts: orthodox religion, liberal religions, and scientific religions. Dogmatic religions tells you have to go to church and follow certain untested beliefs. Its followers believe in one God. It tells you to believe in certain tenets. But if you don't believe them, you are a sinner. Some go to church out of habit, others to pray for money, for a wife, and so on. And some people pray a little, but they don't know why they pray. There are still others who are really devoted to God, blindly following the orthodox way. They get there after many incarnations. This is the dogmatic, blind, theological bullock cart way to God. Then there are the liberal religions. They believe in certain more liberal tenets. They try to analyze a little more. They believe in one God, and they stress the need for silence and for more practical-minded in their analysis of religion, life, etc. This is the horse cart method to God. It will also get you there eventually. The orthodox religionists are taught to fear God and purgatory. Why should we fear God? We should fear our own mistakes, not God. He is very harmless. That is why he doesn't talk, lest he offend us. He is like a little child. You can't fool him with anything except love. God has everything except love, and if you give him love, you will find him. Now, scientific religions ask, why should you be satisfied with words and certain religious discussions? The important thing is, do you know God? Do you know truth? If you have read all the philosophies of the world, you still don't know God. When you are thirsty, when you talk about water, it will not satisfy your thirst. You have to drink. That to where scientific religion comes in. And yoga is the answer. It says you have to commune with God, no matter what your belief is. You have to experience God in your own consciousness. Yogis not only believe in God, as do the orthodox and liberal religionists, but they know him. They follow the scientific highway to God through meditation and practice of certain scientific techniques, balanced with activity for God. This is the path we teach. Our teachings are based on the Rock of Ages, Rock of Communion. That is why our great prophet Krishna said, greater than all paths is the path of yoga, because yoga combines action for God with communion. When you are active, you must be fully conscious of God, and when you are quiet, you must be able to disconnect yourself from the world about you. You will feel your mind is released from your body, and you will go beyond the subconscious state to the superconscious state. Then you begin to experience joy and see lights, but you must dismiss them and go further still until you experience the infinite light. Now that is the religion you are seeking. In India, we have tried everything, all kinds of dogmatic religions. India has tried them all and found yoga, which is better. Yoga gives the communion with God. You have to know God. And how can you do that? By silence. You have to be silent within and without. Then you can come to the domain of yoga. How to relax the muscles and to withdraw the mind and life current into the spine and brain and out into the infinite. Your consciousness is locked up in the three bodies. And if you know how to take your soul out of these three bodies, then you will be free. Just like the three jars filled with salt water once placed within the other and sealed and then placed in the ocean. You have to remove those three jars before the salt water in the last jar can mix with the ocean. Why waste your time? You must spend the nights meditating. Then you will find him. Isn't he wonderful? September 11th has become a date marked in history, and it's a point in time that has come to represent many things in the minds of many people. To many, it's a tragedy. To others, it's the beginning of a war on terrorism. I see it as a time when a shock wave has gone out to the world. It is like an inoculation that has gone into this world consciousness. An inoculation is giving a certain strain of some disease in order to trigger the immune system to spring into action. Now, a good immune system, its job is to identify what is me and what is not me. And when it identifies what is not me, it cordons off whatever that is and pushes it out of the system, or at least constrains it. Our immune systems are constantly on the watch for everything that is not identified, that this is my body, this is me, this is belongs inside of me. And even so, within our minds, if we are living the life as we should live the life, then we are constantly watching our thoughts. Does this belong to me? Is this something that I want in my mental system? And if it is not, I must be on constant guard and pushing it out and cordoning off those thoughts and getting rid of them completely. If I don't do that, then just as a disease can start in the body and start to spread, when the immune system is not doing its job in the body. So in the mental immune system, can mental disease come in, and it causes us unrest, discomfort, and eventually leads us into a darkened state. And so it is absolutely necessary that on a mental level, we are practicing good hygiene, that we are developing a good immune system. First of all, we should identify what is me. What is it that I want to be? Who is it that I want to be? What are the thoughts that I want to have? What are the ones that are helpful to me? And what are the ones that are degrading to me? We all have a mixture of thoughts bubbling up from the subconscious mind, coming to us through worldly projections from other people, from media, from all different sources. Thoughts are constantly coming to us. And take away any of those thoughts, and we have our own thoughts coming up from our subconscious mind. When I went to Cloud Mountain and was in silence, of course, it's one thing to be outwardly silent. That's the easier course. The more difficult course is to become inwardly quiet, inwardly silent. And that, of course, is much more difficult. To become inwardly silent, we must begin to be the observer of our thoughts, of the flow of consciousness that's constantly moving through us. Every moment we have a flow of consciousness coming through us. Every moment there are thoughts that are flowing through our own mind from the unconscious mind. And these thoughts do not come from nowhere. They are all things that we have accepted within our own mind. They are thoughts that have been fed to us from our parents, from those people in our lives that we surround ourselves with by choice, and sometimes not by any choice of our own, but simply because it is. And so all that goes into the subconscious repository. The subconscious mind is like a sponge that simply absorbs whatever is fed into it. And so we must practice good mental hygiene by first identifying what kind of environment do we want to be in? What kind of thoughts do we want to have running up through the subconscious mind? If we constantly expose ourselves to negativity and to those people who have a negative trend of thought, to media that has a constant negativity to it, that is always talking things down, is always depressive and tamasic, then we absorb that. Our subconscious mind takes that in and begins to act on it. And suddenly we may find ourselves with less energy, less enthusiasm, less trust. And because of that, we begin to suffer. And it is because we have surrounded ourselves with those kinds of thoughts. And then the real crime comes when we project that onto other people. And we begin to reflect that through our own words and our own reactions, that negativity. And so it is very, very important what we take into our system, who we associate with. Master oftentimes talked about the power of association, particularly if you're feeling not very strong in an area of your life. And so what do you want to do? You want to rub elbows with successful people, people who have mastered what it is that you are looking to master, people who are very good at whatever area of life you are trying to improve in. And through that constant association, you pick up their thoughts, the way that they behave in the world, the vibration that goes out from them, an air of confidence, an ability to perceive solutions within problems. And through that, you gain a greater strength. It awakens something within you. Plato talked about the role of the teacher, and he compared the teacher to being a midwife. He thought of the knowledge, the gnosis, the wisdom that is to be awakened within you as already existent. Of course, this is a spiritual idea. You are already an awakened and realized soul on some level, only you have not consciously fully come into that. And so the idea is to bring that into your conscious mind. So it's not a matter of bringing in and feeding a lot of facts and figures and knowledge in the way that modern education oftentimes focuses upon what education is. Rather, it's awakening something deep within you. Now, his method was called the Socratic method, and he did it through reasoning. And through certain lines of reasoning, he would try to awaken that understanding, awaken that consciousness within you. But there is this deeper way as well, and perhaps he taught it, but we don't have any evidence of it. But that is to go into the depths of silence. And within the silence of your own being, you have that knowledge, you have that wisdom. Oftentimes when people took problems to Lahiri Mahasaya, his answer to them was, go into meditation. Concentrate here at the Kutastha, here at the Ajna, the third eye point. All your answers reside there. Dive deeper into your consciousness, and there you will find the answers that you are looking for. Isn't that marvelous? We don't have to go to books. We don't even have to go and hear lectures. We have it right within ourselves. Right within. And yet, who takes the time and the effort to access that incredible resource, that source of wisdom, that source of perennial power, that source of upliftment? Why don't we do it? Because we live in a state of ignorance. We really don't believe, ultimately, that it's there. We don't have the faith. Or else we would be running to it. We wouldn't delay. We wouldn't find other things to do. We wouldn't find preoccupations in order to distract us from doing the very thing that would lead us into this inner heaven. But rather we would run to it. We would bend every effort in order to know it, to become it, to live it. And because we don't have real faith in it, because we don't have a real drive for it, we dally our way days away. And we find everything else to do in this world rather than do what we should do. But in the normal course of events, what happens? We have some event that shocks us, that awakens us. Perhaps it is some illness, perhaps it is death, perhaps it is something being taken away from us or we're shaken in some way. And suddenly the world comes into perspective. And we realize that we haven't been focusing on what's really important. And we shift our consciousness, or our consciousness is shifted automatically, and our focus becomes very sharp, very clear, on what is essential. You know, all of us has all of this periphery in life. We have all these details. We have all these things to do, and things that we want to do. And we're consumed in our life by all these details, by all this minutia. And those things always come first. And the essential things get left behind. They get left out somehow. And so this shock comes and hits us. And when that happens, we awaken. And what happens is the light within us awakens. We change, we shift, our consciousness shifts. And that's what's happened with the world. It's like an inoculation, that the shock wave has gone out and you see the results of it. People are turned more inward. It was a couple of weeks after the initial event, and so many places were very quiet. Downtown, city cores were quiet. Office buildings were quiet. Schools that were normally filled with noise were quiet. People's minds were drawn in. And most people's minds were drawn into prayer, into looking for the deeper message within life. Whether it was a fully conscious thing for them or not, nevertheless, it was a spontaneous reaction to this shock that has happened to the world. I thought somewhat humorously that it was interesting that the symbol of these two great buildings in New York City were the financial institutions of the world trade. And that when these things literally collapsed on themselves within an hour or so, the people didn't go downtown and hug their bank buildings and their bankers and say, "Oh, thank God you're still here. You know, I saw this on television, it's so terrible." They gather together in prayer with candles and vigils, praying for the people who lost their lives, praying for the families that were being impacted by this tremendous loss, and praying for this world, for the light to awaken in this world, and the light to awaken within themselves, in order to help this world, to uplift this world. Isn't that a wonderful thing? The first thought was not towards the financial institutions. The first thought was towards God. And so like an inoculation, it comes into the system. But what happens as a result is the immune system of light gets triggered and gets stronger. And so one of the great things that we can do is focus on our own spiritual awakening. That is the single greatest thing that we can do to help this world, to help this world at a time of crisis. Now, this wonderful Chinese character of crisis has this dual meaning to it. And on one side is danger, and on the other side is the opportunity. And I feel like this is exactly that kind of challenge that we have in front of us. It is both dangerous, and there's tremendous opportunity. There's an opportunity to bring this world together in a way that it hasn't been brought together before. We see some evidence of that. But of course, that can be fragile. Those kinds of alliances can break apart very easily. So our prayer is for this light to awaken within all beings, those who perpetrate these crimes, those who are trying to protect societies, those who are the innocent victims, those who are leaving their bodies as a result of the actions that are being taken today, that everyone have that light awakened within them. I took a trip down to California this last week, and flying down, I was thinking about, well, what would happen, you know, sometimes runs through your mind. What would happen if somebody took over this plane and diverted its course? And so a couple of different scenarios ran through my mind. But one of the main things that came to me was to see the light of God burning like a candle flame in the heart of every person on that plane, including the people who had malintent towards those in the plane. To see that light burning steady, calmly, illuminating those souls, so that even if the body were reacting in some fear or some emotion, that even greater is that feeling of that light, the warmth of that light, the calm of that light, the uplifting nature of that light. And then I thought about these individuals who were on those planes. And as they were hijacked and as they were taken into a course that they had no personal control over in that moment. And even in the last moments of their life, to see that light shining within their hearts, to see that calm there, to see that uplifting, thought elevating influence coming up in their hearts, so that they might be focused upon that infinite source of their own being, even during these dramatic moments, and for many of them, the last moments of their life. And what happened to me as I thought about that was a tremendous sense of peace, a sense of connection with God. And one of the great dangers, of course, that we have at a time like now, like this, is fear. And that fear can take us over. That fear can begin to dominate our life. Or that anger can, or any other emotion that begins to dwell, rise up inside of us. So to have that light burning steady, calmly, connecting us to that infinite source, it's one of the greatest things that we can do, both for ourselves and for the world, because that vibration emanates out from us. It influences the people that are in our lives directly. And the vibrations of that go out to the world in general. And if we can use this time as an opportunity to really focus on the light, to really bring ourselves into attunement with the light, to realize that this life on this earth is not our eternal life. It is not where we reside forever. And we've come with a purpose. We've come with a mission. Every one of us has. And so to bring that into mindfulness, that mission, that purpose, that is higher, that is greater than just dealing with the moment-to-moment demands of the world. And to really tune in to your inner knowing, to your inner consciousness, to that laboratory of silence, and draw your strength, your inspiration, your all and all from there. And then what religion is best suited for you? It is the religion of this inner silence, of this realization that comes about as a result of that, and that that is the religion that is taught by all the great religions, whether those practicing those religions realize that that is the essence of their religion or not. They're all working their way towards that essence. And as Master said here, some are going by the bullet court path. Some are going in reverse. Some are being drawn by horse, and so they make a little better speed. Some are going by train and better. But better than all those, as Master oftentimes said, is go by the airplane route of yoga. Use these techniques that have been taught to you. Go into the silence. Feel your communion with the infinite there. And that communion will transform your mind. And so that the divine will become the predominant factor within you. And you will still be human. You will still have a body. But you will realize that in essence, you're a spirit. And not the body. And then you are free, and then you are a light to this world. And isn't that a wonderful gift to be able to give to this world? Are there any thoughts or questions?
It's hard to separate the idea of being peaceful and the idea of saying this line is where your territory ends, is where my toes begin.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's kind of hard to communicate with some people. By being peaceful, they will understand it or they will run over it.
Mm-hmm. And as Krishna pointed out in the Bhagavad Gita, that there is that line, it does not stop you from action. Jesus used the analogy to be harmless as a dove, but wise as a serpent. So a serpent will rattle. It'll hiss. It'll say, get back. That's too much. But you're harmless as a dove. There's no venom in your hiss.
Sometimes if they don't listen to the hiss, you might have to bite.
It's possible. And for instance, we have leaders right now who are charged with the protection of the citizenry. And it's needful for them to protect. That's their dharma. That's what they're there for. And for them not to do that would be for them not to be living up to their dharma. So certainly we have policemen, we have others who it's their job, it's their part in life to uphold the law and order and all the rest of it. And if they don't, then society suffers. And individually, we should not allow people to run over us too much. You know, and each situation is different. In the Mahabharata, the Kauravas would not give back the land that was rightfully the Pandavas. And Krishna gave them every chance. He went there as a mediator. And he said, well, even give them 5 villages. They're supposed to get half the kingdom. He says, give them 5 villages. No. They'll get nothing. Well, then you're left with no choice. Because to let that go means that the ego gets to rule. And things just become very chaotic and very dark from there on. So there are those times where we stand up and we say, no, that is not acceptable. Nevertheless, inwardly, we don't fight with that venom. It doesn't stop us from action because that venom gets turned in on us. And that venom is a kind of hatred, a kind of seething emotion that takes us over, and we're no longer acting with our mind imbued in the light, directed on the light, but we are reacting out of emotion. And that emotion takes us over the line. I think all of us here, at some point, have said some words that later on we thought, you know, I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I hadn't gone there. It was too far. It was over the line. And it's because emotion carried us beyond what wisdom would have had us do. And for the realized soul, and what we are all aiming for is to always be residing in that light, to have that center, to have that place of peace inside that can measure those things before they pass from us. So that if things are coming from an emotionally charged state that blinds us to the light, then that is what we have to prevent. Now, we can act out of emotional state, but totally residing in the light. Jesus got very angry, throwing the people out of the temple who were money changers and selling and buying within the temple. And he displayed a lot of anger in doing that. But I would think that as someone who's master of himself, that he was always in control. And that the anger was not ruling the show, but the light, the righteous anger that was coming from him was.
Yeah, he was just impersonally sweeping the doorstep
off. Yeah. So that's our challenge, and it's a terrific challenge, and we are the ones who know. We know whether we stepped over that line or not. To other people, they may not be able to distinguish. It may look like, you know, Papa got very mad one time at the ashram. There was a fellow there who was behaving improperly. And so Papa went to throw him out. The fellow refused to come out of his room. Finally, he came out of his room. Papa told him to leave. He was refusing. Papa started kicking him and pushing him and yelling at him and telling him to get out. There were people who left the ashram because they believed that Papa was not who he said he was. They saw him reacting from an emotional standpoint, and that he was not master of himself.
And he was just communicating with his son, the little guy could understand.
The fellow would not leave. You know, and here we talk about the immune system. If Papa doesn't get rid of him, if he doesn't cordon him off and get him out of there, then he poisons the whole atmosphere there. So it's absolutely necessary for him to do that. And the fellow was refusing to leave. Papa just rose, you know, his energy up to match this other fellow's energy to stay, and had to overwhelm him to get him out.
Yeah.
You know, another option is to call the police or, you know, other kinds of things, but that's what Papa did. And it's a big test for a lot of people there. Because they said, he's human, he's not divine, and he's not what he says he is. So that's their test. Of course, Ram Dass didn't care what other people thought. You know, what does he care for his reputation? He's focused on the light. And that's true for all of us. If we are focused on the light and focused on doing what is right, according to our own light within our own being, then all the world may disagree with us. But if we've tested it out and to our minds we have satisfied ourselves that this is the light, that's it. Discussion's over. And we have to do that. And if we don't, we become cut off from the light. We get immersed in darkness. And how are we doing anybody any good by going along with somebody else's fear or somebody else's idea about how we should be when we're ignoring the light within our own being? We're lost. And we become the lost leading the lost.
I haven't met a lot of people in this world that had any points to pass out. Or should I try to make them happy if there's that kind of a conflict?
Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, I think that we can take it that it is for the highest good of everybody by abiding by the light within our own being. It's not just good for me, because the light isn't concerned just with me. Oftentimes, the light will take us into places that we'd prefer not to go to, that are difficult. And so, the light is not just concerned with me, but this is where our integrity is at stake. We have to the best of our own ability, to abide by that light. But as Master is talking about Sri Yukteswar tonight, he never coerced anybody. He never forced anybody. He would try to reason with people. But if people won't be led, then you drop it. You let it go.
How do you feel yourself up emotionally if you do something over and over again that feels right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't get any response and you feel like it's coming from a good seat within you, in fact, you get a lot of resistance. I find that I'll do something and I really feel it's right, and I'll repeat it, and I'll get absolute support, and then I feel really abandoned inside. And there should be a feedback loop within me that makes me feel good that I'm doing the right thing, and
yes.
I'm totally feeling empty. Doing the right thing should make me feel good.
Yes.
It's like I just feel more and more frightened and more abandoned. And yet I really felt that my intention was good and that I wasn't doing something wrong.
We have to be careful, and this is all part of all of our sadhana, but we have to be careful as to whether something is coming from a mental construct that we've divined through our own reasoning process, or whether it is coming from the deeper soul springs within us. If we have gone into the quietness of our own being, into the stillness of our own being, and this has come up as the truth, I feel this with every cell in my being, that this is the right thing for me to do. And we test it, and it comes back from us, not just from a mental construct, not through reasoning, but through that deeper communion with God. That is our touchstone. That place inside of us where we feel that rightness, that correctness, also brings with it the surety, the feeling of surety, and the feeling of calm and peace that's within us. And so anytime that we are questioned about what we're doing, anytime that we question ourselves about what we're doing, we can go back to that wellspring. We can go back to that place inside of us that we touched that said, yes, this is the right thing to do. And along with that will come a sense of calm, a sense of peace, and the comforter that Jesus talked about will be there. So sometimes we do get a true inspiration and said, yes, this is the way. Then it becomes more of a mental thing. Okay, I believe this. So I gotta get in here with my will and I just gotta make this happen. Or we actually get disconnected from that source, from that spring of intuition that initially gave us that realization. And so it's a matter of then going back to that source again and again and again. What happens is it begins to build a solid foundation inside of us. Every time we go back and we say, is this true? Is this right? And then the answer comes back, yes. It's like another brick in the foundation. And so every time we have the question, and then it comes back as an affirmative, it puts another brick in the foundation. And then we have this solid platform to stand on. And it seems like no matter what comes to shove us off of that, and things will, that's just as surely as the sun's going to rise, oppositional force is going to come to us. But every time that comes to us, we can stand on that solid foundation. And it's intuitionally derived, but it's an actual feeling and a source of power within us, as well as a source of comfort.
Okay, since I tend to go into the mental state and do what you just said, then to get back to a sense of the intuitional inspiration that prompted me in the first place,
yes.
Do I have to do that by talking to my feelings? Because I'm in my mind, the intuition or inspiration came through me. I didn't force it to happen.
Right.
So how do you get back to that?
Yeah. And sometimes the things just do come to us. They seem spontaneous. What we don't oftentimes realize is that many times those spontaneous intuitions are a product of the spiritual work we've been doing. Even though we're not actively meditating in that moment, it's the culmination of all the spiritual work we've been doing comes in that particular moment. And so to get back to that place means to get calm within yourself. Ask the question. Just ask God. Is this the right thing? Am I? Because there's ways that we can get pieces of inspiration and then our mind gets in there and starts working with it and suddenly it takes on a little twist that wasn't there before. Or it takes on a little different angle that is an invention of our mind versus that pure intuition that we started with. So go back to that purity of that inspiration. Become quiet, ask God, is this right for me? Is this the right thing that I'm being given here? Am I acting in the right way? And then turn it over to God. Just ask the question and then become quiet and wait. And sometimes it comes to you immediately and you know it. Yes, I know that this is true. Or you get some kind of message about, well, it's part right and part wrong. You know, you got this much and then the mind took it this extra length over here. And so we get back to what we were originally given. Or we have to wait for a while. And we just have to wait in silence. We have to wait in quiet. And we do that. We wait some more. Now, if we're forced into action, if there's something demanding that we act and we don't have, then we use our reason and we just pray to God. God, you guide my reason. I have to make a decision here. I'm not clear what you want from me here, but you guide my reason. You guide my will. You guide my activities. And then we do our very best to attune ourselves to the light, to the highest light that we know in that moment. But if we're not forced into action, then we wait. And that keeps our mind on God. What is that answer? What is the right thing here for me? You're just like a child who's asking the question, and you just stick with it until you get an answer. And you see how that strengthens your spiritual life. It strengthens your connection with God. Mm-hmm. And you can feel it inside of you. The foundation gets built. You can feel it brick by brick. It all gets built. And there comes a time when you don't even need to ask the question, or as soon as you ask the question, you know the answer. You're solid. You're rock solid on it. But it comes from a place very deep inside of you. It's not just a mental construct. That's doing the work. And we have to do the work. And this is essential to our sadhana. This is our sadhana. And it's where we live. It's everyday decisions. It's how we live our lives.
Yeah.
And it's all encompassing. It's every aspect. It's our relationships. It's our finances. It's how we interact with the world in general. It's everything. It's everything. You can't divide out anything and separate it out.
I was thinking today where I thought I was doing the right thing and helping the whole nine yards, and then I lost it, and then I think because of the work I've been doing, I got it through Jerry was the calm influence that stayed calm regardless of everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like, it was all the work I had done. That
yeah.
God could reflect that back to me at that moment when I really
right.
needed it.
Right. Because you could have those influences in your life and not even see them just because you're not there. You haven't done the work.
Yeah.
But when you do the work, you can use another person, their calmness, their, you go, ah, that's what I want. That's what I want. And you have the eyes to see and you have the ears to hear. You know, it's been quite interesting with this announcement of marriage to Carla. Not everybody has been all that thrilled about it. Some people think that it's a fall. So it's, you know, some pretty stiff challenges around that. And it's required me to go back and do that exactly what I'm describing. Go back and go inside and to that place, is this the right thing? Now to me, that's much stronger than taking a position and saying, well, yes, of course, it's the right thing for me. You know, it's an automatic kind of response. But to go inside every time, and now it's just like a well-worn path. It's just like, is this the right thing for me? And it's yes. And the support, the comfort, the clarity, the surety is all right there.
So the doubt actually becomes, in a sense, allowing yourself, the doubt becomes a constructive influence.
Absolutely.
Rather than how we usually think of doubt as a destructive.
Doubt is really, in this case, it's the question. This is true. Now, habitual doubt, no matter what happens, I don't know. That's a weak thing. It's mentally a weak thing. But it's when I want to know the truth here, I demand to know the truth here, that's strong. And that's direct. And when we take that to God, it's very strong and direct. And that's what Lari Mahasi used to say. Take it inside. Get the answer. Then you go to the source of all answers. And the more we go on that path, the more often we go back to that well, the easier it gets. We know it. We trust in it.
And it's perfect practice. I keep hearing this. Perfect practice makes it perfect.
Yeah.
And if you go back and, yes, it's the truth, you've just learned, you've just practiced getting the truth.
Yeah.
And if you can do it with a question that you already know the truth.
It is. And it's wonderful because it's pertinent to us. It's not taking some dry philosophical point and, well, what is truth? You know, it's like, what do I do here? And what's true? What is true? In this situation, at this time, for me, I'm vitally, you know, wanting to know. Because this is my life and it matters.
My test with this glory that I think gets it kind of the brain and the two pieces has been me going to India, which 3 months ago was the truth, and I knew that I was supposed to go to India. And as my life has been unfolded the last 3 months, it's been clear that it's not the right thing to do. You know, I have a new son, blah blah blah. There's lots of reasons I shouldn't go. That it's not even maybe morally correct for me mm-hmm. to go. But the truth is I need to go to India.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I take it back, and that's what David said, go out.
Yeah. And it transcends societal norms. It transcends everything else in our life. And we have to be willing to be devastated. To do whatever it takes to abide by that truth. And sometimes it just levels us. And all of our own expectations can be very different than what the truth is. And that is the crucifixion. It is this upward propulsion force that crosses the horizontal, worldly kind of considerations. And it's on those kinds of things that we face that crucifixion that we have to overcome.
I have to say, even though that's true, at the same time, I firmly believe that when it is truly spiritually for the good, then it's actually going to be all good, and it'll affect the very things that you doubt.
Mm-hmm. But you don't always know that beforehand. You can't always reason it through or know how that's gonna all work out in the end.
Or even during.
In the middle. Sometimes not even after, but
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But usually the evidence starts pouring in at some point, and you see, you know, if this over here hadn't happened, then this would not have happened. And you see the whole chain of events, and you go, yeah, it did work. But there's no way that I could have known that at the time. I didn't have enough information. And that is the mind's problem, is it never has enough information.
You know, David, as far as ministering as an example, I think of when you and Albie split, and what a tough decision that was for you.
It's the hardest thing in my entire life.
And it was hard on a lot of people, not just Albie.
Yeah.
And I imagine that was a time when you went back lots and lots of times to ask.
Oh, I resisted it like crazy.
And I just, when I was watching it, I just thought, you know, this isn't David's nature. It's not, you know, it seems like your nature is to be very loyal and very steady. And I thought how tough that must have been.
Yeah.
And I just thought that you were very much doing the right thing, but it was a very difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was a good ministry by example.
Mm. I tell you that...
I knew you'd never want to hurt anybody.
No.
Not Albie or anybody.
Well, and it affected all the group, too.
Yeah, I know.
Because we were holding services at our house, and... As a focal point, and oh, absolutely.
Nobody
absolutely.
Asks to be an example.
Not if they're sane. So, that's very true, Peter. It's just, and it was a matter of going back. And it was very interesting because the answer, I tried to look in every other direction, but where that prompting was coming from. And suddenly I was surrounded by it. I couldn't ignore it. And even then, God showed me that if I didn't respond to that, that I would become very, very ill and maybe die. And I said, well, so be it. You know, my commitment, my pledge is towards this marriage, and so be it. If I die, that's better than to break my word. And God said, no, that would be committing suicide, and that is a worse sin in comparison.
Boy.
And that was one of the things that finally, all right then. It started to clear the way for me that I could listen to that. But that was many, many months of absolute torture for me. And most people, you know, didn't understand or didn't believe that it could be a prompting coming from God. I couldn't. It took me months and months and months to argue with God about this. So, as I say, it can destroy your world. Your concept of yourself, your concept of how you see yourself in the world itself. And unless we're willing to surrender to that, and let go of everything of what we think is the right thing. And surrender to that inner prompting. Then we can't follow the path. We're just simply taken out of it. And we can't know all the reasons in the middle of it, in the beginning or in the middle of it, of why this is happening. Or we can trust that it's going to work out for the highest good of all. And certainly that should be our prayer. May this work out for the highest good of all.
But, you know, for me, watching you, when you talked over at the last week, Jerry's talked about your path to reaching the decision to get married.
Mm-hmm.
It hit me like a ton of bricks after that evening or within a week. But this, even though it wasn't like that, this was a huge challenge for you in terms of your change of your own identity.
Mm-hmm.
Because it puzzled me after you had gotten the word from Swami Satchitananda why you need Yogananda.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw you built a huge core identity mm-hmm. with your line of gurus.
Mm-hmm.
This was hugely foundational for you.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it showed me that, being a romantic, I'm going, oh, hey, that should be right? Love mm-hmm. America. And all of a sudden, I saw how it was a huge challenge for you. And it was an act of surrender once again, except that this is going into my career.
This is joyful surrender. The other was pure painful surrender.
Surrender to abundance.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always nice when God takes us in that direction. But also the demand to know that it's the right thing. Is this human desire? Is this divine desire? Is this for the highest good of all? No small thing for me.
Yeah. No, I mean, you had asked, it kind of reminds me of in the prophet, love goes down and shakes the very roots of your nature. And to me, that was shaking the very roots of your nature.
Yeah.
On this huge core for you, because mm-hmm. you've been a loner so much of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So I just felt this was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it!
And it was nice getting Swamiji's confirmation as well, because he's the confirmed ascetic, you know, the sannyasi.
Oh.
So it's nice. It's nice.
The Hindu version of confirmed bachelor.
Yeah.
But, you know, some exception, he doesn't strike me as I don't know, something about him.
And the ashram is a place for families.
Yes.
It's there's children there. There's, it's really a lovely family atmosphere there.
Well,
so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Do you want to read it? So, you know, in every one of our lives is a journey like this. You know, this is my journey in my life. But each one of us have our own journeys, have our own lives. And I think one of the things for me, just in the evolution of consciousness, is learning to take that my life counts. It's to take it seriously, that the decisions I make count. And that's true for each one of us. But I think we grow into that. There's a way of kind of living unconsciously in our lives that we just kind of go along with the flow of things and really coming to realize that, you know, what we do counts and taking our lives much more seriously. This is the letter that Swamiji sent to me in response to my question. I told him that I was submitting this to him as Mother had taught us to do. And that if he said no, that was the end of it for me. That would be the decision. And if he said yes, I would take that as God's inner direction. For Yogacharya David Hickenbottom, Grihastha Ashram, which is marriage in the family home, is not an undesirable institution detrimental to the spiritual progress of man. This is a quote from Swami Ram Dass. On the other hand, when life is lived in its proper spirit, there is no institution more noble and more glorious than the married life. A man can make his home a center of service, radiating rays of universal love. Quote from Swami Ram Dass. And then from Swamiji. Your loving letter of 27th April to hand. It was, of course, a surprise to go through the contents. As beloved Papa says, God arranges everything at the proper time. This is also God's will. Married life is not a bar to God realization. Only we have to see that we keep up the tempo of our aspiration for God realization. That you have chosen a partner who has been helping you in Mother's work for the past 4 years and is quite a dedicated devotee, is sure to bring more understanding and harmony between you two, and you will be helping each other in your sadhana. May beloved Papa and Mother's blessings be upon you, for leading a purposeful life towards God realization, resulting in eternal happiness. Satchitananda. So that was quite lovely to receive. Thank you, Cora. I thought they did those in private.
Exhibition is good. Well, and part of it is because you put me up to it. David had mentioned that I had this prediction several years ago, and so then I got all high and mighty, of course, as I often do, of Carla and David's wedding, and thought, now why did David have to check it out with all these holy people? Because I already predicted it, so that was God's thing. And so I tried to get Larry and David to bite on this when I was visiting with them one day, and they kind of... And Larry kept talking something about causal
something.
Something
about
communism. And so I thought, well, I guess I better go mad at Dave. So I said, so who was it that told me this? And anyway, if there's things going on, who told me this anyway? And Sri Yukteswar came to my mind, and I know he works in the astral, helps us in the astral thing, and I got this sense of the strong sense of my kind of premonition things that have been coming, that and me thinking I know all these truths, and Larry and David are like the big brothers who have been driving for a long time, and I'm the 6-year-old who says, but I know how to drive, I know how to drive, just push those things, do the thing. And so I had a good laugh on myself of realizing that I've gotten a taste of things.
So you keep your hands on the wheel at 10 and 2. What
so
do you
I'm
do the rest
in
of
my
the
car
day?
Seat. I'm standing in my car seat with my seatbelt buckled tight.
And it's so nice to know that these masters are focused on us. And they don't see us as something beneath themselves. They are really sincerely desiring to have our spiritual progress more than anything else. And will do all to help us in whatever way that they can. It's lovely to know.
Joyfully.
And joyfully. Well, a couple of announcements before we close. One is we have some CD, a new CD of Mother's Talks that are available up there for you all. Also on next Saturday, we'll be having a Holy Science class over in Sunnyside. So any of you who would like to make the trip over, of course, most welcome, and we'll be meeting at Larry and Kate's on Sunday.
What time is on Saturday?
It'll be evening, I imagine 7:30. I think it's there.
Kind of
yeah, you'd be most welcome too. Yeah.
7:30 in Sunnyside?
Then we'll have our normal service at Larry and Kate's and too next week on Sunday. Yeah, but the Saturday will be sunny. November 3rd, we're going to have a silent retreat. Some people have been talking about missing the silent retreats from Cloud Mountain. So Rich has offered his house up at Whidbey Island. And so on Saturday, November the 3rd, we'll have a silent retreat there from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And you're all invited to that as well. I think that's it. Anything else? 2 weeks from this weekend, so I'm not quite sure what the dates, but I was going to go this weekend. We'll do healing ohms tonight, but you may or may not know, but Johnny's son died. He had high cholesterol. I think he was just maybe 40 or so. He has an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old child. Lived in Edmonton. And he had has genetic high cholesterol, but had had no heart problems. But suddenly died of a heart attack. So it came as quite a shock. And it was difficult, and I had planned on going up and doing the clearing, charging class up there this weekend, but I'll be going up in 2 weekends.
Also, 2 weeks from tonight, we'll have our last service here at the house. And so I assume it'll be at the Culver's after that. By default.
Mm-hmm. It'll be at the Schultz's in Ashland.
Every Sunday.